It's a hard life on women for a fact. Some women. I mind my mammy lived to be 70 and more. Worked every day, rain or shine. Never a sick day since her last chap was born. Until one day she kind of looked around her. And then she went and taken that lace-trimmed nightgown she had had for 45 years and never wore out of the chest. And put it on and lay down on the bed. And pull the covers up and shut her eyes. You all will have to look out for Pa the best you can, she said. I'm tired.
Hello, and welcome to episode 23 of the Great American Novel Podcast. I am Kirk Kernut.
And I'm Scott Yarbrough.
And what great classic of American literature are we doing this week, Scott?
We are finally returning to an author we've covered before. There are a lot of great books out there, but there are also a number of our authors who are worthy of having more than one book considered in our discussion. So this discussion is on Azalea Dying by William Faulkner.
Very interesting that this book has surged in prominence or popularity maybe in the last 30 years. I don't know about you, Scott, but when I was in college, we did not read Azalea Dying on the syllabus. That was considered sort of a quote-unquote beginner Faulkner. Maybe a little Faulkner, not Faulkner light. That would be maybe The Unvanquished. But certainly the book back then that you would have cut your teeth on was The Sound and the Fury, which was a very difficult book to read. Now, this one is no Easter parade. It is a tough book for reasons that we'll get into. But it does have a reputation of being the acceptable edge of the unacceptably difficult Faulkner, if you want to call it that. So what's your sense of the status of As I Lay Dying over the years?
I think as of right now, As I Lay Dying is probably, as you and I were saying earlier, it's got to be the most taught Faulkner novel of all these days. And part of that is because it is in the Norton Anthology of American Literature and all the other anthologies now, and there are special critical editions on the book. And although there are elements about it which are tough and complicated and reflect Faulkner's interest in modernist approaches to literature, it isn't comparable in terms of complexity to The Sound and the Fury, which is very challenging for first-time readers in those first two sections, or even Light in August, which has a kind of white-hot density of prose throughout the novel. Many of these sections are very easy to read. There's a remarkable use of vernacular and diction throughout. He captures the sound and the cadence of country people in the Delta South of the day in a way that very few writers were capable of doing at the time. And it's a book that I think is really landmark in many ways that maybe for a long time he wasn't given credit for as well. And I do think for people who are looking at Light in August, Absalom, Absalom, Go Down Moses, this is, of all those, the most accessible. And that's why it has that reputation you talked about.
Right. We should put this in the context of the books that you just mentioned, where it comes in the chronology. It's a little convoluted here because this is the second published book in what we consider the great sequence from 1929 to 1942 of Faulkner's best work. It was published in 1930, was actually written very quickly in a matter of 2 months, 2 to 3 months, in the fall of 1929, just as The Sound and the Fury was being published. It was actually not the second book of this series that he wrote, though. He actually preceded it in earlier 29 by writing Sanctuary. However, when he sent that to his publisher, and again, Faulkner's publishers is another convoluted story, but suffice to say that the folks that published The Sound and the Fury, even before that book came out, Faulkner sent him the manuscript for Sanctuary, a guy named Harrison Smith or Hal Smith, and he basically told him...
He said, good God, Bill, you get us thrown in jail.
If you've read Sanctuary, you know it's essentially a Southern Gothic version of Dashiell Hammett. Great book, and it's gotten a lot of attention in recent years. I don't know that it's necessarily up there with The Sound and the Fury or Absalom.
But you know what he did do is after he sent the first draft of Sanctuary in, he had them, after Sound and the Fury took off critically. It never took off in terms of sales, of course. But after critics weighed in on it and he started becoming known for Sound and Fury, he actually, and this is remarkable if you know anything about how desperate for money Faulkner was up until he wins the Nobel Prize, he actually paid the publisher to rewrite the novel after it was already in galleys to improve the aesthetic, artistic quality. What's interesting about Sanctuary, and I know we're off on a rabbit trail here as we want to get back to As They Lay Dying, what's interesting is the criminal and crime and violence elements, which you may think are what he's trying to change, don't really evolve or change. It's simply the structure and the writing and how he deals with his attorney character, Horace Benbow, that shifts. So you can read the original draft is actually published as well. And you can read those side by side. It's very interesting.
It's the book that was a notorious success when it came out in 1931 and got Faulkner a reputation as the corn cob man, unfortunately, due to a graphic use of a corn cob in one particular scene. But in the fall of 1929, after Sanctuary was momentarily rejected or put on ice, Faulkner, who had just gotten married to a divorcee, very uncommon back in the day, Estelle Oldham, he needed to have a regular job. He was, at this point, 32 years old, living with his parents.
Yep.
So he had to get a job, and he took a unique job. Years earlier, he'd been the postman at the University of Mississippi, ran that post office not very well. But this time, he got a job as the manager of the university power plant, which meant that he worked from 6 p.m. to 9 a.m.
And mostly it was regulating the intake, outtake of the various coal burning machines and shoveling, arranging the coal and shoveling coal into the burners. And that, of course, meant he sat around most of the night and didn't have much else to do with his time.
Although I think he sold himself as a coal passer. That's the technical term for it. I think he was mostly a supervisor, and he was telling the African-American workmen which piles to shovel from.
Well, that's probably true.
But the gist of it is that in that 12-hour shift overnight, he did have huge chunks of time, and he was able to crank this book out in a amazingly quick fashion, made even more amazing by the fact that he always boasted that he never had to revise any of it after it was done. What we're reading is supposedly a first draft. Now, I think most critics would say there's probably a little bit of revision going on.
Right.
But there are a couple important quotes that he would later come and talk about As I Lay Dying about. So he says, "When I began the book, I discovered what it was and knew it. And it would also be missing in this case because this would be a deliberate book." And I think that's one of the reasons that it is a very accessible version of Faulkner, the deliberateness of the book. There is a constant plot progression, even though we have some fallbacks into memory and some flashbacks. But the idea of the deliberate book is he knew the ending right from the beginning, and he was plowing on this in terms of form.
Yep.
And we'll talk about why the ending works so well. But you can almost think of this as a long setup for a joke in many ways. So before we get too much more into it, I guess we should offer a bit of a summary. So Scott, you want to tell us what the book is basically about?
Absolutely. And as always, since these podcasts try to be a little bit of a friendly entree into literary criticism and discussions, it's not the same as a review where we're saying something's good or bad. We're not trying to necessarily argue in favor of something. Most of these books we think are pretty good. We wouldn't do these. Instead, we're trying to help explain them, which really means be warned, there be spoilers here. And so with that in mind, if you haven't read the book, you know, read it and then come back and listen to this or read it as you go along. So we have a family of people in the years after World War I and before the publication date in 1930 who are out in the countryside of Yotnocktaffa County, quite a bit removed from the county seat of Jefferson. And in the early chapters, the matriarch of the Bundren family is dying. And so we have her husband, aunts, her sons, Cash, Darl, Jewel, a daughter, Deweydale, and then a younger son, Vardaman. And the story is told by jumping from narrator to narrator back and forth. There are 15 different narrators operating in the book. And after Addie, the matriarch, dies, she had wrung a promise from her husband that instead of being buried nearby where the Bundren family had been buried, she has to be taken by wagon to the town of Jefferson and the cemetery there where her people have been buried. And you see in that divisiveness a whole lot of what's going on in this book. And it's complicated because there has been a ton of flooding and bridges are washed out. So it becomes kind of an epic journey to lay her body to rest. And there is a famous Mississippi flood in 1927 that Faulkner writes about repeatedly. And there's some speculation that some of the flooding is supposed to be going on here, but it may just be a more regional series of storms and floods as well.
It's a little tricky with his syntax in the quote I was just reading, but basically because the plot came to him all of one piece and it was an end-driven book, the element that Faulkner argued that he did not feel as he was writing this was sort of the ecstasy of discovery, of figuring out what the book is as you go along. So I think that's another reason that that it doesn't feel as digressive as maybe other Faulkner books do. This one has a definite plot, and you mentioned it as a journey. It's in many ways it can be thought of as a parody of the Quest narrative. In other words, you've got these people on a journey, but Faulkner, as the creator, dumps every conceivable misfortune upon them, and it's almost elemental. We have flood, we have fire, we have life and death, all kinds of mixed into one.
Yeah,
and I guess one of the difficulties of the book is the tone, because you're never quite sure, is this a comedy or a tragedy or a tragicomedy? You want to weigh in on that just for a second, Scott?
Well, you know, one of the things I think that is not often enough talked about with Faulkner is how funny so many of his books are. Even the very tragic Sound and the Fury, there are wry statements and observations. You know, the great villain of Sound and the Fury, Jason Compton, is also kind of hilarious in the way that really just evil, bad people in books and films can be hilarious since they have no filter. They say whatever they think. There are parts of him where you just shake your head and kind of can't help but chuckle. And in this section, we have, of course, their neighbor, the farmer Tull, who's this wry outside observer from a slightly more normal farm family who talks about ants and how useless he is and how people judge Darl and all the other things that go on, and says things like, you know, when he saw his mule looking at him from across the river, he thought there's no way I could go back to it, you know, and just the self-deprecating humor. There's all that in there. But there's also, in addition to that, there are these weird sequences with the characters, and there's this building sense of, for lack of a better term, sadness for what's going to happen to the family. And part of it is, I think you could argue, and I would argue, that the second generation of his family never had a chance. They're stuck with two of the worst parents in the history of parenting. And I would maybe start us off with the discussion of the epic quest. You know, the most significant Faulkner critic of the first 30 or 40 years of Faulkner criticism has to be Cleanthes Brooks with his book, Yaknoptofa Country. And he's the one who really talks about the epic quest here. But I think in a lot of ways, that's not really that helpful, other than I think there's two things going on. One is the actual title, As I Lay Dying, comes from an epigram from the Odyssey. And it's down talking in part about the descent into hell. And I think one of the things that people need to do is not do the macro, the Odyssey is an epic myth, so therefore this is an epic story, but do the micro. What's going on when they descend into hell in the Odyssey? Well, they're going to talk to the ghosts of their ancestors and to famous seers to get information on what they need to do. And one of the people that Odysseus runs into, who pops up in modernist literature over and over again, he's in the Wasteland, he's referenced in other works as well in different oblique ways, is Tiresias. So the blind seer, who at one point, of course, is cursed to be female for a while to feel like what it's like to be used and abused really as a woman, and to have more empathy and sympathy for people. And Eliot makes great headway with that in The Wasteland. And I think that's weighing a little bit on what Faulkner's doing here, because we do have one character who's distinct from all the others, and that's Darl.
Darl is, in a sense, our center of consciousness, although, you know, he recurs. But he does have the most chapters devoted to him.
That's right.
And I think most critics kind of see him as some kind of version of the artistic consciousness, in as much as any of these characters have that. I wanted to comment on the title a little bit, though. The quote that you're referring to from the Odyssey is, "As I lay dying, the woman with the dog's eyes would not close my eyelids for me as I descended right into Hades." And I just want to say that modernist literature was the best era ever for titles. The idea was you did a deep dive into classical literature and you found a great poetic phrase that you built the entire theme of your book around.
Yep.
One of my complaints about contemporary publishing is all of the titles are so damn literal.
Yeah.
They don't interest me.
Or they're puns based on previous great titles.
Right.
That are not interesting in themselves unless you know about the great title earlier. But
if we
look just at Faulkner, you know, As I Lay Dying, The Sound and the Fury. Light in August, Sanctuary.
Go Down Moses.
And there's a lot of course, old King James Version of the Bible references used in these things as well. And we can really point to Fitzgerald and Hemingway, all the great references to literature, to mythology, to religion, and all the ways they use it. It really was a golden time. And it is a shame to go to a bookstore now and read books that just, again, have, it might as well be like a generic supplement that says, you know, angry young teen novel.
I used to have a riff that I would do with classes where I said, if The Catcher in the Rye were published today, it would be called Depressed at 16.
Yeah.
A good exercise is to think about what this novel would be published today. Some editor would sit there and go, you know, that title is just a little too depressing. Books with dying in the title don't sell. So this book would probably be called The Journey if it were done today.
Or The Really Hard Journey. This digression's actually really on point. When Random House started publishing Faulkner, they bought his rights basically from Bonnie and Live Right, the small-time publishers who published his first few books. They knew they weren't going to make a lot of money on him in the short run.
Yeah.
So they were hedging their bets that even though none of these guys' books are going to be bestsellers, they're going to keep selling year out and year in, and they're just going to keep selling and keep selling. And of course, that's exactly what has happened. Faulkner has not been in the top 10 list, except maybe the Summer of Faulkner that Oprah did some years ago. But every bookstore you go into in the United States and pretty much any other country is going to have at least a handful of Faulkner novels there. And they're stocking them because they sell. Someone we'll be talking about later who was a competitor of his and more popular and a better seller than him when they were alive and they're more or less contemporaries in terms of age and publishing. You can't find that guy's books anywhere now.
Yeah.
But Faulkner's still there. And so today, since almost all the publishers are owned by just four gigantic corporations, then it really is all about the bottom line. And I'm sure there are editors doing everything they can to find significant text and to really promote outstanding work. But I think they're handcuffed by the bosses and the suits. Yeah. We're saying, well, the shareholders want to see the chart. They won't see that graph spike. So what we need is another good young adult angel vampire werewolf romance novel.
I think the only time that I can remember when Bennett Cerf, who was the founder of Random House, intervened and basically told Faulkner, you can't use that title for a book, it's too literary, is when he did his sort of second pot boiler in 1938, 39, a book he wanted to call, if I forget the Jerusalem.
Right.
but which came out under the title The Wild Palms. Now, The Wild Palms is probably a better noir title.
Right.
Maybe fits that book a little more in terms of mood or tone. But If I Forget Thee, Jerusalem comes straight out of the Bible. And again, a lot of these allusions are just, that's how you tell you're dealing with a modernist work.
So much of it goes back to Eliot. There is this great focus on incorporating various texts out of classic antiquity, out of epics and out of legends. So we see it with Delta Wedding by Eudora Welty coming kind of the tail end of this time period. You've got little splashes of it in Hemingway referencing the Fisher King in three or four different texts. You have it in Fitzgerald just a little. I don't think he had a lot of tolerance for people overindulging in this in his long fiction. Some of the short stories he does more.
He originally wanted to title The Great Gatsby after a character in Satyricon named Trimalchio, which may have been the second most bad literary reference after I Forget Thee, Jerusalem.
And we thank you, Maxwell Perkins, for heading that one off.
But the title, As I Lay Dying, is literally relevant because one of our main characters, Addie, the mother figure to all of these children, does die in the book. And one of the most remarkable chapters is her post-death monologue.
Right. Told in present tense, mostly right in the middle of the book, longest chapter in the book. And it is remarkable. And in fact, I think to continue kind of talking about how this book is modernist. So for people who don't study this stuff all the time, when we say modernism, the first thing is we're really talking roughly, although some of it starts before World War One, we're roughly in American literature talking about the period between the two world wars. And we're talking about how either in terms of style and form and structure, the writers tend to take chances and be experimental and do complicated things. Or thematically, it's all about the kind of loss of the old ways, how things are falling apart. We don't have faith. We don't have love. It's all just lust and superstition and nothing makes sense anymore. The center will not hold, to quote William Butler Yeats, one of the great modernist poets. So, In Faulkner, what's interesting, so someone like T.S. Eliot or Virginia Woolf and James Joyce, you get both and. They're doing it both in terms of the style and the theme.
Right.
And then you have someone like Fitzgerald, and leaving aside maybe Tenders and Night, he's mostly just focused on the thematics and not stylistically doing such modernist things, in the bigger works anyway. Hemingway's a little more stylistically in that direction in terms of all the things he leaves out in the incredible eye for detail and the great use of figurative language, but it's still more about theme than anything else. Well, Faulkner, his themes are his own. He's not so much worried about what everyone else is doing in this post-World War One world. He's interested in the South and all the particular demons of the South, the race, obsession with the past, the legacy of family, the legacy of all the harm we do each other, how we carry those things around. And it's less following the overall world and, or I should say, Western imprint or even the American project. And it's really more his own particular Southern version of these things as he kind of carves his own niche in these books. And I think you could argue in some ways, in terms of really focusing on how structurally to get to his point, this one is right up there at the Absalom and Absalom in terms of the form really matching the goals of what he's doing in the art.
Another way in which if you're a writer today that publishers would discourage is the use of multiple narrators.
Yeah.
And what makes this book a little more accessible than, say, The Sound and the Fury is, in terms of modernist technique, when it came time to represent the relationship between the individual and external reality, modernists believed that phenomenon was objective, that sight was the center of consciousness. A lot of this was being drawn from Freud. And the idea was they developed a technique sort of independently, but Dorothy Richardson, James Joyce, Virginia Woolf, they were all experimenting with a technique of, in terms of practice, it's really almost automatic writing, but it would come to be known as stream of consciousness.
Yeah.
And Faulkner certainly inherited that from Joyce and that high modernist culture. This book is a little bit different because we have a type of presentation that is maybe one step backward from that, which is interior monologue. And a lot of what these chapters are presented as are as characters.
Yeah.
We open every chapter, we're given the name of the person. So there's very rarely ever a mystery about who is the speaker. Although in some of these chapters, there's an effort to imagine other people's thinking, and we flow in and out of different perceptions.
Well, we're really with just one focus, but we'll come back to that.
Right, right. But interior monologue is just a little bit shy of stream of consciousness.
Right.
There's just a little bit more structure, a little more focus, not quite so random.
You know, Faulkner does something that most of the other writers at this time weren't so willing to do, in that he mostly has the characters such as the younger brother, Jewel, or Armstead, a farmer, or Toll, the farmer, Toll's wife, Cora, all speak the way you would expect these people to speak in their interior monologues. But he gives Darl a level of poetic diction.
Yeah.
It's simply not imaginable for a guy who grew up on a farm in the Mississippi Delta and seems to, as far as we can tell, had briefly gone off to World War I.
Yeah.
And then come home having been presumably wounded from some of the more or less obscure references to they had to dig the land out of his head or something like that.
That's one of the ways in which we know he's kind of the artist figure of the book, is he has that
right
poetic tendency. And he also undergoes a crack up toward the end of the book and speaks of himself in third person. There's some experimentation with dissociation there as well.
Right.
I think that another way of thinking of interior monologue is it's related to the theater or to forms of literature that have analogs to the soliloquy. And so some of these chapters are often described as dramatic monologues, like I guess Robert Browning was the poet we think of as the expert in dramatic monologues, My Last Duchess.
Yeah, My Last Duchess, yeah.
But this is the idea where the entire literature is one long internal speech by a character, and you are sort of deducing the external situation. We never see the scene outside of that particular character.
Yeah.
It's a great form for dramatizing or juxtaposing, which is another key modernist technique, different perspectives.
When I think of the multiple perspective novel, all the earlier ones I can think of that do it usually through third person omniscient.
Right.
And they jump back and forth a lot, often clumsily. So that would be your French writers in the, you know, latter part of the 18th century, early 19th century, throughout the 19th century. By the middle 1800s, we have Tolstoy doing it. We have Dostoevsky coming along then. And what you don't ever see before are the shifting multiple first person
right
perspectives. I've been trying to think. I taught this last spring and I asked my students, because this technique becomes pretty common as it's filtered down. You see it in science fiction novels.
Mm-hmm.
You see it in mysteries. You see it in what we might call middlebrow novels. And many other literary writers will use the alternating multiple first-person points of view, where we have different ways of speaking, observing, and the perspective changes based on who saw it. It all stems really from a little bit Sound and the Fury, which has three instances of that. But mostly this novel, with, again, 59 chapters with 15 different narrators. And one chapter is a single sentence.
Right.
And other chapters tend to go to some length. Darl narrates 31% of them.
And keep in mind that, as you said, these chapters are often feel like very splintered. They're very rarely longer than 6 or 7 or 8 pages. They tend to focus on a specific moment. So maybe for contemporary audiences, one of the best analogies would be to almost like a documentary. You can almost think of these characters as talking heads.
Yeah.
It's become very common in fiction to present narratives, especially when they're depicting trends in popular culture, as doing these documentary style oral histories.
Right.
Now, those have a format where you're juxtaposing them right against each other. So it's a little bit different, but you can almost imagine visually, if this were a series of interviews with these characters, we would be flicking on the screen back and forth to different speakers, and that sort of brevity of the quote, you get a very small a glimpse. I think all of this is building up to the idea that this is one of the first works to me that Faulkner was really obsessed with the idea of what does language do. In other words, he thematizes language. And I would just point out that probably the most quoted line out of Addie's monologue, her post-mortem monologue, is she's talking about the word love. Mm. And she says, "Ants," the husband, "had a word too, love he called it, but I had been used to words for a long time. I knew that that word was like the others, just a shape to fill a lack."
Yeah.
I love that. The idea that a word is a box that contains nothing. It's a word to fill a space.
Well, and that compares to one of the weirdest things in the book that I think modern audiences read right over and don't think how weird it would be. And it's in a Cash chapter. And he talks about how he's built the... actually, it's in Tull, I guess, but Cash is obsessed with the shape of the casket, and Cash is a carpenter who builds the casket for his mother, and he weights it so that it'll balance. It's in a what they call a clock shape, and in your edition, there's actually a bit of a drawn-in coffin shape in the actual text, which nowadays with computers and graphic design software, it's easy to just find that thing and plug it in there. No big deal. I just imagine the copy editors who got this from Faulkner and saw it hand-drawn into, and so how are we going to do this? But they did, and they were used to the challenges from him. You remember his first notion of Sound and Fury is they're going to use multiple color inks to show time slippages for Benji.
That was very much a modernist trick too, to somehow do this. Although it also, I remember being in college and trying to read Tristram Shandy, and there was one whole chapter that was, what was it, lines or something? I mean, it was just...
Well, remember the chapter where he says, "I went up the stairs and it was really dark, it looked like this"?
Yeah.
And you turn the page and it's just a completely black page. You can't see anything.
There's playing with the conventions of print, in other words.
Yeah. And in the early days, before hypertext came to mean a link on computer documents to another web page, hypertext in the 50s and 60s was what they meant when the actual layout on the page carried meaning. Like if you had words that swirled around or were suddenly bold or suddenly italicized. And so the textual critics of the day refer to that as hypertext and that kind of thing. Faulkner's onto from the start.
I'm glad you mentioned Cash because and his carpentry, because I think that we've talked about Darryl representing the poet side of Faulkner. It's important to understand that Faulkner was also a carpenter. I mean, he pretty much rebuilt most of around this period when he and Estelle were purchasing Roanoke, which is the house you can still go visit. It's a tourist attraction in Oxford, Mississippi. You know, he did most of the refurbishing of it himself. And he often used metaphors of carpentry to describe fictional forms. It was all about driving the nails straight. No fancy scroll work or ornamentation, but you found the structure by balancing it out. And one of the first things I remember about my experience reading as I Lay Dying, probably in my early 20s, was I didn't know what the hell the word bevel meant, and had to go and realize, okay, this is all about proportion and order and trying to find some sort of stability, which is a very modernist theme in structure.
Well, it's that idea of balance, right? It's all about balance. So the casket has to be on a balanced bevel, is leaning together the horizontal and vertical planes in a way to achieve a structural balance as well. What's great about Cash is he's so exacting in everything. He has that, every character in here has one sequence or chapter you just love, or one speech you just love. So he has a chapter which is 13 reasons why he made it on the bevel. And of course, some of it doesn't make any sense and shows a little bit of a kind of, again, country guy, uneducated country guy's understanding of things. He goes, it'll bear to stress because of animal magnetism. Well, animal magnetism has nothing to do with the weight a body has on a joint. It has to do with, people's pheromonal attraction for each other, I guess. But he calls it that. And it's just, so in that, they ask him, when he fell off the working on the top of the, was it a barn or the church? Yeah, he's on the roof of a church building it. He said, how far did you fall? He goes, 28 feet, 4.5 inches, about.
There's a desire for exactitude there, and it dramatizes all of the character search for order. One of the things I would also say about this is connecting with Faulkner's other works. You could argue that As I Lay Dying is a version of The Sound and the Fury because the characters break down among the same types. You have Daryl, who's a version of Quentin. You have Dewey Dell, who we haven't mentioned that she's pregnant in this novel, and that's a version of Caddy Compson.
Yeah.
You have two versions of Quentin here, Cash and Jewel. And I will say that sometimes in this book, I struggle to keep Cash and Jewel distinct. If there's any characters that overlap to me, it's those two. But maybe most importantly, I don't think he's the most important character, but he's maybe has the most famous one sentence in this book, is the young child who is Vardaman, named after the governor who invented the term redneck as a positive, who was very overt proponent of lynching, by the way.
Vardaman. Yeah.
The child whose most famous statement in this book is, "My mother is a fish."
I will tell you, if you read the book closely, there's a logic to the insanity of that statement, but you do have to be really paying attention.
Yeah.
There's another weird thing going on here. I think before we jump into the other characters, maybe we should start with just a quick description of the parents. So we have Ants, who is a small-time farmer in Mississippi. And I'll ask you, Kirk,
yep.
You don't live far from Mississippi. Does it get pretty hot in Montgomery in the summertime?
Well, sitting in a room that until about 40 minutes ago had no air conditioning, I can say yes.
Yeah, our heat index yesterday was 106. That's heat and humidity together. And although it's this year seems exceptionally hot, as everyone has written, it's not completely unknown level of heat. Yet Ants is the man who believes, as a farmer, that if he ever sweats, he will die.
Right.
And so here's a farmer who cannot work up a sweat, which means everyone else has to do everything for him. He is a paean to selfishness. He's horrific.
Yeah.
And then we have Addie, and you will find plenty of people in various journal articles and online who see her as a kind of feminist heroine. And I have to say, I just don't get it, because when she thinks of the kids, when she starts teaching, she says, "I would hate my father for having ever planted me." When she thinks of kids, "I would look forward to the times when they faltered so I could whip them. When a switch fell, I could feel it upon my flesh. When it welted and ridged, it was my blood that ran. I would think with each blow of the switch, now you're aware of me. Now I'm sending your secret and selfish life, who have marked your blood with my own forever and ever." So here's a school teacher who enjoys beating kids till they bleed. And I think we do feel sympathy for her, because no one in history should have to put up with Ants. But making her into the heroine of the novel, I think, is flat out reading it wrong. We do hear from her talking about Ants. He did not know he was dead when Ants tells her, "We ain't nigh done chapping." Her reaction to having kids is an awful lot like Edna's reaction when she sees Adele Ratignol have the children at the end of The Awakening by Kate Chopin, where she witnesses the scene of torture. You know, not the miracle of childbirth, not the beauty of motherhood, but the scene of torture.
Yeah.
Except for the child she has from her affair with the local preacher. And that one she loves and is special. That's the third child, Jewel.
And she loves him because he's a product of sin and wickedness.
Sin and wickedness. And I think she doesn't want to admit it, but also actual love. It's the one time she can love someone.
Addie is the symbol of nihilism in a way. It's a character who does not have any belief that there's anything good in life. And I think her upbringing demonstrate that. I mean, she grew up under a father who basically told him here that we were born to die.
Yeah.
There's just a long sense of life struggle. And I think that sort of gets reinscribed in the idea of what does the poverty class have to look forward to in life other than toil and labor and no lack of ever improving their lives.
Yeah.
It's a world without love, or a character without love.
So here's a novel where it's all about each character's perspective. And we have one character who unnerves the others because he sees things he shouldn't ought to see.
Right.
And that's Darl. And one of the questions any reader of the novel has to ask themselves is, how much does he know? How much does he infer? Does he truly have second sight? If you're reading the book, literally, he seems to. He'll read a thought from Dewey Dell's mind or from Peabody's mind, the doctor, or someone else, and then it'll be repeated in their chapters as their own thoughts.
Yeah.
And so we have this kind of verification that he is actually sensing what they see. And of course, their response to that is they all distrust him. They don't like how he looks at them. Tull says at one point, "There's never anything he did so much as just the way he looked at you."
Well, he intuits the two main secrets of the novel, one of which is that Jewel is a product of adultery. Doesn't know whose father right. it is, but he knows he's not, you know, Jewel is not his complete brother.
Right.
But he also is the one that intuits that Dewey Dell is pregnant.
Right. And her response to that is rage at him that builds and simmers and builds and simmers till we get to the climax of the novel. And it's really a sad, sad moment. She is, of course, scared to death. We don't know her actual age, but you gather, I mean, probably what, 17, 18, something like that, maybe a little younger.
Yeah.
We know that Darl and Cash and Jewel are all older than her. Jewel's not that old. Other clues that he's a product of an affair outside the wedding bonds is he's a head taller than the other guys, who I guess are average height, and Jewel's particularly tall. And then we have Dewey Dell, who's also, we feel sympathy for it. In the section where she talks about getting pregnant is famous and beautifully written, not about getting pregnant, but about just the first time she slept with Leif, her boyfriend, or Leif, who of course kind of vanishes once she lets him know what's going on. So maybe I shouldn't say boyfriend.
Well, Faulkner was intrigued by the quote unquote fallen woman. I mean, this is a version of two novels down the line, if you count Sanctuary, Light in August, which also has an unwed mother, Lena Grove, as one of its principal figures. And I think that reflects his empathy for the outsider.
Yeah.
His awareness of the hypocrisy of especially upper class Southern society, where they would shun
yeah.
a woman who was fallen when everybody knew people were having relations outside of marriage.
He really does target hypocrisy over and over again. And there is a tendency to yeah. try and hold some of his characters, some of his work, and he himself up to our modern, very enlightened 2023 standards. And I always say very enlightened with big air quotes around it, because I really think every stage of humankind thinks they've advanced things the furthest and it's the best it could be. And we're so much better than they used to be back in those dark ages. And there's a real self-congratulatory, self-aggrandizing, pedestal climbing moment there that makes you not look too carefully at your own problems when you do that.
Right.
And certainly Faulkner was not as progressive as many of us would have him be on race relations today, but he was progressive enough to be burned in effigy in downtown Oxford. And I've certainly never taken a yeah. stand that's gotten me burned in effigy.
And to be threatened by the KKK.
Right. And his brother.
Yeah. So, who is the head of a local white citizens council.
Right. He's going against his actual close blood relations on some of this stuff. Dewey Dell, you know, her famous line is at the end of the chapter when she's getting more and more worried and thinking about what's going to happen. "I feel like a wet seed wild in the hot, blind earth." And yeah. that is one of the things when Faulkner is cooking on all gas, the quality of poetry in the writing, just page after page, something just spirals out at you that astounds you at the beauty of it, the ability to capture pathos and to bring things forward.
One of the things that I like about characters like Dewey Dell and Lena Grove is that Faulkner avoided the trap of depicting these impoverished women as hillbilly sex objects, which was very common in depictions of the poor class of women that usually ended up in some version of prostitution. I think he had a basic attraction to the fallen woman and makes them much more rounded and interesting, even in their relative lack of literacy, than other writers of this period.
Absolutely. We know that cliche doesn't really go away when we have the characters, you know, who come around on the Beverly Hillbillies in the
yeah.
early 60s. What is it? Is it
Ellie Mae?
Ellie Mae, again, you know, wears cut off jeans and beautiful mm-hmm. and the shirts that are tied, you know, kind of low cut and tied across the middle. And that exact same cliche 20 something years later is replayed almost verbatim by Daisy Duke.
Right.
And they do the same thing with in yep. the Dukes of Hazzard that they did in Beverly Hillbillies. They kind of desexualize her by making her a relative. And so at least they're not going through that next cliche of, you know, the Southern cliche of incest.
Exactly. She's a little more complex than maybe Rosa Sharon out of the Grapes of Wrath, whose function is mainly symbolic there to be a kind of thwarted mother, abandoned woman. But you were speaking about the brutality of some of these interior monologues and how he has a way of really infusing the speech of villains with just great black humor. There's a chapter toward the end where basically in order to get, you know, some kind of abortion medicine that she knows is not really abortion medicine, she's got to negotiate this sexual exchange with a really skeezy soda jerk at the local pharmacy, named Skeet McGowan. And his monologue is as funny and gross as any sort of anti-hero, you know, antagonist monologue I can think of. He had just such a great way of capturing modern slang and doing it in a way that was repulsively funny.
Once you have read Sound and a Fury a few times and the reprehensible elements of Jason Compson the second are no longer, they don't sting so much because you're used to them, suddenly you realize this guy's just, he's hilarious. And a lot of times it's in the grand tradition of the interior monologue. He doesn't know when he's telling things on himself, you know, calling Benji, his younger brother, was mentally handicapped and probably has a mind of a 3-year-old and a body of a 33-year-old. He calls him the Great American Gelding because they've castrated him because of his, all those elements of it. You know, as we think about this notion of Darl's insight and his secondary sight, you know, it just shows up in all these different ways. But there are other things Faulkner does to show all these conflicts and angles. One of the more interesting and very observable elements is the use of how people are aligned with either vertical or horizontal ways of being. So Ants talks about, you know, when God wants you something to move, he lays it lengthways, like a horse or a snake or a road. But a man is built like stand a corn or trees, up and down. So he's supposed to stay put. And later, of course, the doctor jokes and says we wouldn't have a deforestation problem in the country if he'd have given trees feet and given people like Ants Bundren roots. Everything had been fine. And then we see Jewel, for example, and Addie's laid out in the coffin horizontally. Jewel is tied to that horse, an animal that's identified as horizontal. Vardaman is obsessed with going to see the train, this long horizontal object. You know, and Dewydale feels like a seed growing in the blind earth, so something growing up that way. And Cash wants balance. He's always trying to find balance. So he climbs up high on the building and he has fallen before this happens and broke his leg one time. Then they have to cross a river, which is the thing that's all horizontal. And bad things happen, as they will. And when it goes over, Cash, who's not able to jump in time, probably because he's holding on to the reins with the mules, gets his leg broken. And so he's hurt by any time things are out of balance. And that's what he's has to have. And the question is, you know, where do we associate Darl? And the answer seems to be he's with the horizontal. He has the spyglass. He's the one who's gone away. He's gone places and come back. And I would throw out to you, Kurt, that this whole back and forth, horizontal and vertical, show up in weird ways in the book 3 or 4 times. We talked about Cash and his injuries. The other place is when the wagon is broken down on the side of the road and there's the ditch is flooding. They have to create a fulcrum. Well, fulcrum in physics is when you have the horizontal lever over something vertical to act as a fulcrum. And so, again, we see it's having to use leverage, fulcrum, balance to move something larger. That's also the scene where Darl projects and sees the death of Addie. And he tells Jewel just after Addie dies, you know, Addie Bundren has died. And he doesn't call her mother, because we have this whole notion of, you know, Dewey Dale refers to Jewel as he's not care-kin to us. He only cares about his mother, and he does love his mother. And Darl is constantly prodding Jewel to make him acknowledge that he has real siblings and they love him. Jewel refuses to do it. Jewel only really cares about his mother, and the others just don't matter to him that much. And it's all interesting. You see the kind of sibling simmering right. problems that most families have to a degree, just boiling over in places in this book under the pressure of Addie's death. There's one other kind of conflation of the vertical and horizontal I think we want to come back to, but what about this whole use of when Addie dies is told in present tense?
Well, I think that's a way of dramatizing the immediacy of perception and the way that our subjectivity does not allow us to see synoptic view, the overarching view of things. So many of these characters are stuck, mired in the mud. You could almost argue that a synoptic view is a vertical view. You go up and you see above you, but all the characters can see what is immediately what's right in front of them. And that,
and you know, and I did make a mistake. Everything you're saying is absolutely right. I think most of that chapter probably does go into past tense or little present tense elements in it. But yeah, and could you define for people just that structural notion? And I don't know if this comes out of Claude Levi-Strauss or someone even before him, but we have synoptic, which is right here, right now, slice,
right,
and then diachronic, which covers it over a length of time, right? I guess we'd call it longitudinal and latitudinal.
Well, I think synoptic is an overview. That's the way I've always used it. So maybe it's more of a synonym for diachronic. But the perceptual immediacy, I think, is what that present tense usually allows you to think of. You know, I think it's the immediacy of voice, where you have characters saying things, even when it's in past tense. We're not dealing with recollections from years ago. We're dealing with stuff that has happened an hour ago, minutes ago. And so it's a way of sort of balancing or trying to dramatize the way you're stuck in the here and now and unable to shape or control the past in a lot of ways.
There is some weird stuff going on in this book with verb tense. When Darl says she's not was, but is, not is, but was, and as soon as I find it, I'll come back to it. The other thing, when we think of Vardaman and his mother is a fish, well, he catches a fish and he takes and shows off the fish, and you gather some long gar fish. It's not worth eating. And they say, clean it. So he takes an axe and chops it into mush, and he brings it in the house, and Dewey still says, and his mother's alive.
Yeah.
Dewey Dale says, that's disgusting. And she puts it away, and Vardaman sees that it's vanished. And then he hears his mother has died. He goes, well, we have this miraculous disappearance of the fish.
Right.
And mother dies. That has to be connected. So then later he thinks that, well, she's really still alive and she has to breathe in there and she's a fish. So he takes a drill, a hand drill, not an electric one, of course, and he augers his way down and really grotesquely goes too far and drills into her face, and they stop that. But when the wagon goes over, Vardaman's running around saying, catch her, Darl, don't let her get away. Don't let her get away, because she's a fish. So the whole bizarreness of my mother is a fish does, in Vardaman's head, no, don't get me wrong, I think in some ways, you know, Vardaman is what in the South we've always called a little touched in the head.
Mm-hmm.
But for that matter, so is Cash. So is Jewel. So is Dewey Dale. So is Ants.
So is Darl. Obviously. Yeah. That whole my mother is a fish thing too. It's another way of Faulkner dramatizing the randomness of language. I mean, you could get very philosophical here and say, is there an organic connection between the thing and the word that refers to the thing? And, you know, most of us would argue that language is arbitrary, that we just develop words to fit certain objects, and that there's no inherent connection between the two of them. And I think that's part of what the whole my mother is a fish thing. It's just so absurd. That's what the Dadaists were doing as well, you know, and just creating nonsense. And in this way, you get a sense of part of what's driving Vardaman's confusion is he doesn't have a language for grieving the death of his mother. And he's not in therapy. He's not allowed to talk this out. There's not a rest cure for grief.
Oh, good point.
He's just almost randomly associating words with these emotions.
With Darryl, and I noticed that some of us say Darryl, some say Daryl, and it kind of depends who it is, how we pronounce the name. I don't know which is correct. I need to go back and see if I can find a recording of Faulkner using that somewhere. We have a section that's at the end of one of when Addie dies and Darryl and Jewel are away to deliver the lumber and get the money for it. And it ends with this kind of monologue from Darryl where he says, "In a strange room, you must empty yourself for sleep. And before you're emptied for sleep, what are you? When you are emptied for sleep, you are not. And when you are filled with sleep, you never were. I don't know what I am. I don't know if I am or not. Jewel knows he is because he does not know that he does not know whether he is or not. He cannot empty himself for sleep because he is not what he is, and he is what he is not. Beyond the unlamped wall, I can hear the rain shaping the wagon that desires, the load that is no longer theirs that felled and sought it, nor yet theirs that bought it, and which is not ours either, lie on our wagon, though it does, since only the wind and the rain shape it only to Jewel and me that are not asleep. And since sleep is not, and rain and wind are was, it is not. Yet the wagon is, because when the wagon is was, Addie Bundren will not be. And Jewel is, so Addie Bundren must be, and then I must be, or I could not empty myself for sleep in a strange room. And so if I'm not emptied yet, I am is. How often have I lain beneath rain on a strange roof thinking of home?"
I think you read a passage like that and you go, there's a reason that Faulkner is called the American Shakespeare.
Yeah.
That is the type of monologue you'd get straight out of Hamlet. And both Darryl and Vardaman are often described as Shakespearean characters, version of Hamlet, but also a fool.
Yeah.
I just think that poetic inquiry into what is being and the nature of what it means to exist is a large part of what he's interested in here. And the play with tense, is versus was, it just dramatizes that so vividly.
I think he's doing something weird with it even further. And this is something I've talked about students and I've done a fair amount of research on it. And I'm not sure people pick up on it, but as things get worse and worse, Darryl finally decides this is destroying the family. We've got to let it end. And he tries to burn his mother's corpse in a funeral pyre of a neighbor's barn.
Yeah.
And he tries to make sure to get the animals out and all that, but he messes up because Jewel's so intent on saving his mother, who predicted that he will save me from flood and he will save me from fire. And he does. That Jewel gets burned, and so Darryl has all this guilt, and he's seen crying, and Dewey Dell puts the pieces together, makes her own inference, and to get the money back that their father has taken away in order to pay for the mules they need to get to town,
right,
and to get himself those teeth, new set of teeth. She's dead, you know, God's will be done, now I can get them teeth. She sells him out. His sister sells him out, and when they come for Darryl toward the end, we get in those last few chapters, it's been present tense all this time. And then in the last 20 pages of the book, Cash says it wasn't nothing else to do. And so Pa said, and first, and he start trying to understand why Darryl is the way he is. And he says, you know, Darryl's crossed a line by destroying people's property. So for Cash, everything laid out. What I put in our notes is Darryl's kind of made a scapegoat for everyone else's problems, right? Vardaman wants a train. Ants is a horrible father and a horrible husband, and he wants the teeth. Dewey Dell wants to have her pregnancy taken care of. Jewel wants to be able to get his horse and go off away from these people. Cash wants to be able to work on these buildings. He's not going to be able to do it now with his broken leg, and he wants to buy a phonograph or tape recorder or something weird, like maybe a wire recorder. It's a talking machine, they call it.
It's a little gramophone.
Yeah, gramophone, that's it. And Darryl's here for the rest of them. And so they sacrifice him. And so if we have a kind of conjoining of the horizontal and vertical, one of the things that forms is, of course, a cross. And I don't think you can use that kind of symbolism throughout the book. But here at the end, he is sacrificed so that the others don't have to pay for their sins. And then we take it further and we say, well, why is Cash named Cash? Well, one of the betrayers of Caesar is Cassius.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, Christ is betrayed for 30 pieces of silver, which is to say cash. And to me, the most heartbreaking scene in the whole book is when he looks at cash and says, I thought you would have told me. I never thought you wouldn't have. So he doesn't have any expectations seeing the rest of them, but he expected Cash to act like his brother. And
right.
And it's just horrible all through here. And of course, the very ending is something special. But then he's had this thing he talks about throughout the book, Kirk, where he says, if you could just ravel out into time, if you could just ravel out into time.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is, during all these scenes of insight and all these jumping back into seeing things that happened, and when we think about that sequence where he says, how often have I lain beneath a strange roof, listening to the rain, thinking of home? Is there some part of us that's, are we supposed to think that much of this story, and I don't know if I really believe this, I'm just throwing it out there, that maybe much of this story is being told after the fact by a kind of post-breakdown, post-psychic break Darl looking back and recreating personas or structures or notions? I don't know.
That's a great suggestion. It reminds me of the endless debates about, is there one narrator in the wasteland or are there several?
Yeah.
And to what degree is Tiresias the figure who narrates in parts,
yeah,
the avatar of all of these different people? I think it's unanswerable. And that's what makes it literature,
yeah,
is that you can make equally compelling arguments in both directions.
Right.
And really for this generation, ambiguity was key to the definition of literariness.
Yeah.
And just the fact that I think that Faulkner takes people that we so commonly write off as either white trash or poor, and he infuses them with a depth of suffering without making them noble, tragic victims. So much of this book is, it's impossible to separate the tragedy from the comedy.
Yeah.
And I think that that's part of what makes it compelling as well.
I think you touched on one of the things that Faulkner does better than almost anyone. And I would say that if a listener has only read the two books we've talked about with Faulkner, well, first, you've read two really great books. But secondly, you are missing the kind of third incredibly important element to his writing, which is the consideration of race. Now, you do have a lot of that in Absalom, but he goes far deeper and darker, and he refuses to automatically demonize anyone or automatically, nobilize or heroize anyone. People are always dealt with as true, completely three-dimensional characters first and humans first before they really become a symbol of something. It's not to say he doesn't have a few paper villains or non-rounded characters. Every book has those, but very few other writers can compare to the ability to bring into relief the human struggle, and as he puts it, the human heart in conflict with itself.
And this is something that I think few of his contemporaries would do. I mean, just the idea of infusing a poor person with a sort of Shakespearean depth.
Yeah.
You're not going to find that in T.S. Eliot. You're certainly not going to find that in F. Scott Fitzgerald. So I think it's a sign of his overlooked humaneness that even as he's piling indignity upon indignity on these people, that he's allowing the full dimension of their tragedy to be articulated.
Kirk, many years ago, I was going into a movie theater to see my favorite newer directors who had a new movie coming out called Barton Fink.
Mm-hmm.
And this was the first, second, third, fourth movie of the Coen brothers, I believe.
Right.
And Barton Fink is about a playwright, probably a little bit based on Clifford Odets, maybe a couple other kind of socialist playwrights of the Depression era, going out to Hollywood and trying to become a movie writer and getting stuck. And he stumbles into a writer named W.P. or William P. Mayhew, who's very clearly Faulkner.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this kind of lampooning of Faulkner and tribute. And actually, I published an article on Faulkner criticism through Barton Fink years ago in Faulkner Journal. And one of the things in there that struck me is he has such a hold on our understanding in popular culture terms. And what other writers had that? Well, clearly Hemingway, where we have mostly a popular culture understanding of him and very little apprehension of the actual texts. Shakespeare, Jane Austen. That's a pretty short list, isn't it? Maybe Mark Twain.
I think what's neat about Barton Fink is that's the one fictional version of Faulkner that I can think of. I mean, there's a bazillion Hemingway fictionalizations and more Fitzgerald, Scott and Zelda ones. In fact, I'd be all for calling a moratorium on dramatizing Scott and Zelda. But I'm profoundly ambivalent about that depiction of Faulkner in there. It's there's parts of it that are funny. His big epic novel is called Nebuchadnezzar, which is their version of Absalom.
Right.
But it's also, they're clearly playing up to the stereotype of Faulkner the drunk and,
right,
you know, the disillusioned Hollywood hack. And this is a pre-Hollywood Faulkner that's writing this novel.
Yeah.
When he is full of ambition and fire at the age of 32, turning 33, and really living on a confidence,
yep,
that is really remarkable. And to think of how quickly he progressed in 1927 and 28, you know, first three novels are very, very spotty. And then discovering that ability in The Sound and the Fury to use all of these techniques. And what he says about that allowed him to do that was to turn his back on the marketplace and write the novel that needed to be written for itself. As a writer, that's very hard to do.
His output in that 28 and 29 through 42 time period is unmarked. I mean, I think you have to go to Shakespeare to find anyone that matches it.
Yeah.
I don't care who you want to put up there. If you just look at the total number of incredible books and then the next level down of pretty good books, there's just no one who you can match with it. I mean, it's astounding what he does.
It exasperated Hemingway in Death in the Afternoon in 1932. He stitched in a few insults. It was like, just about the time you're finished reading one Faulkner novel, there's another one. He's got a new one out. And, you know, Hemingway would go through 7 or 8 year, 10 year stretches between novels.
Yeah.
So I think the speed and the fury with which Faulkner was able to write, never mind the short stories. He was a very prolific.
No pun intended.
He's a very prolific short story writer as well. And it's right after the time that he's doing this one and then rewriting Sanctuary that he really commits himself to making a living through writing of short stories. And so he's cranking out a couple hundred short stories that we tend to think of the Southern ones being the obvious ones, but he's doing a lot of stuff that's different. One of his big successes was a World War I short story about boats, about certain types of boats that were being used. And that became his ticket to Hollywood, was when that short story sold to Hollywood.
I love the story of he and Howard Hawks going quail hunting when he's in Hollywood, and Clark Gable comes along, and Clark Gable says to him, "What do you do, Mr. Faulkner?" And Faulkner's got a little bit of rep by this point. He goes, "Well, I'm a writer." "What do you do, Mr. Gable?"
Yeah.
You were also telling me there's a metal band named Azalea Dying as well, right?
So, in a very Faulknerian history, this was a metal band that came out maybe 23, 24 years ago. Its lead singer in 2014 actually went to prison for soliciting the murder of his estranged wife. So,
wow.
Very few bands have that kind of history. So it's kind of ironic that they would choose to name themselves after supposedly a Christian band, too. So even more twisted in that way.
I guess he caught up on his reading, but it made touring a little hard.
Yeah. Yeah. So we can't talk about this book without talking about the last line, though.
Have you noticed that Cash gives away the ending early in his section?
It's taken me a long time to read this before I did catch that.
I can't tell you how many times I've read this book, more than any other thing of his I've read. And it's probably in the top 5 or 6 novels I've read the most. And it's only after Cash says, "We pulled up to Miss Spundren's house." And then finally, here we get to the very end, which is told by Cash.
Mm-hmm.
And Pa comes up. "Yeah, do you want to read it? Or do you want me to?"
"You go ahead."
I'll try to do it in a crazy, weird, rednecky voice. "But it's Cash and Jewel and Vardaman and Dewey Dell," Pa says, kind of hangdog and proud, too, with his teeth and all, even if he wouldn't look at us. "Meet Mrs. Bundren," he says. I have always been so perplexed by that whole thing. He never, ever leaves the farm. How could he couldn't have had an affair going on in Jefferson, could he?
It's almost like he got the new teeth and found him a wife the same day.
Like he put him in, went and talked to the lady when he borrowed the shovel, said, well, we got to have us a new wife out there for Chapin out at the farm.
That's the joke of the book, is that how easily Addie has been replaced.
By ants, anyway.
And it boils down to this long journey has all been for naught.
Yeah.
It's a kind of commentary on the pointlessness, the existential pointlessness of existence, if you want to call it that way. And you can see again why he called this a deliberate book. He knew the ending from the beginning, and this is all one right. big setup to the end of that joke.
The other term he always says is a deliberately set out to write a tour de force.
Right.
What do you think that term means? Because I hear it used a little differently, and I'm never quite satisfied with it. I think I know, but I want to hear what you say.
I think he understood that Sound and the Fury was a great novel because it was accidental. You know, he discovered it as he went along.
Right.
Again, I go back to Cash. It's almost like he's building something out of all of these great principles of carpentry, craftsmanship, and understanding how when you know the ending, you see it and everything goes toward the completion of the design that you have in mind. And design is a big word in Faulkner. If you go back to our discussion of Absalom, that's what topples Sutpen, is his design.
Right.
And so if you think of metaphors of artistic creation, you know, most writers will probably want to tell you that things are fortuitous. That's where genius comes from. But at least in this case for Faulkner, it was, I knew the end from the beginning, and that's why I didn't have to revise it all.
Supposedly, he wrote it all on one side of a legal pad and probably a set of legal pads, and then he would use the back of the page to write notes and little tweaks, so a little bit of as-he-went revision. But it is a remarkable novel. You and I were talking before, not only with the metal band issues, but there are other references and other songs. We had a recent, not too long back, film version with
James Franco,
thank you.
He did two Faulkner movies back to back. He did As I Lay Dying and Sound and the Fury. So
right.
This is surprisingly better than you would expect. I mean, James Franco has kind of taken a dive in people's estimation due to Me Too issues, but Sound and the Fury is unwatchable because he plays Benji and there's a lot of that unfortunate temptation to ham it up when playing a person with disabilities. You know, if you've ever seen Tropic Thunder, you know the description for that.
Yeah.
Can't say it, but you know it. I don't think this works as either a stage play or as a movie because it's so much about voice. And one of the things that struck me was there have been a lot of adaptations of this, but the one I want to tell you about that intrigues me the most was the very first one. And in 1935, this is when Faulkner is, you know, sort of more known among the avant-garde than really a popular writer. In France, a guy named Jean-Louis Barrault adapted As I Lay Dying. It was staged through pantomime and surrealistic settings. Only words were used from Addie's monologue. I would love to see a version of that. Other ones, the guy that adapted The Grapes of Wrath for Chicago Steppenwolf Theater did a version of it in 1995 that I don't think was very successful, in part because, again, when you make these voices come out of bodies, you're tying the voice, the language, so much to a person. And it takes something away from the ephemerality of the words.
I thought he did about as good a job with this movie as you could do. But I agree with you. There are a lot of literary novels, especially when it's all about the diction and the voice and the writing itself, that simply don't translate. When plot is less important and it's the how you tell something that's more important, in the same way that most Faulkner has never been turned into any kind of good films, it's the reason why Cormac McCarthy's Blood Meridian has not yet been turned into a film. They might now with the kind of wash of interest with his death, but I don't think it'll ever exactly capture what reading that novel is like any more than this one. And he does do the trick of having people kind of staring off into the space, and then you hear the voiceover monologue in a couple places. He doesn't do it as much as I would. The casting is surprisingly pretty good. I mean, he makes these for shoestring budgets, and Danny McBride is Toll, and Tim Blake Nelson as Ants Bundren is inspired casting.
The thing that struck me when I first saw it was a lot better than I expected.
Well, it's no 1950s version of Sanctuary, or the not the 50s, but the version of Sanctuary, the story of Temple Drake.
Yeah.
Or the version of Sound and the Fury where Jason and his niece are having a taboo relationship and romance, and it cuts out most of Benji and all of Quentin, and is just truly a horrible movie that seems to have absolutely no grasp of what that novel was about.
The unfortunate thing that happens when Faulkner is adapted to film is it tends to emphasize the melodramatic qualities. And I think a radio script, there have been radio adaptions that I think have fared probably better than any film version. So I guess ultimately our question is this a great American novel, Scott?
Well, from my perspective, is it American enough? And does it have American themes? Does it? Absolutely. As we've said before, because something is about a kind of sub portion of American culture, doesn't make it any less important. Whether we're talking about, you know, Mexican American immigrants working in Monterey, California, or any other kind of group, it still, I think, holds. And I also think that whole idea of trying to find dignity and humanity in people who have these lives of diminished expectations is really important. I also think it has a significant artistic accomplishment. I think it's remarkable. I think there are very few novels that stack up against it in terms of the quality of the prose, the clarity of the vision, the use of structure and themes in ways that are not invasive, but rather support the whole piece, to use a kind of bad pun. And our question of heft and scope and depth, it is, in terms of word count, shorter than a lot of them, but it's not any shorter than Their Eyes Are Watching God or The Great Gatsby. So in every way, it's a great American novel. And of course, it has a durability of it still in print everywhere today.
It's hard for me to think of another novel that could qualify as a great American novel that doesn't somehow overtly address the issue of democracy or representative individualism. I think it has been handicapped across many years because it doesn't overtly deal with race, which is one of the central American themes. But I also agree that to me it is, in part because it takes a population that is almost invisible. Well, let's put it this way. In the great American novels in which you see the impoverished people, and Grapes of Wrath is probably the most obvious one, there is a desire to ennoble them. And I think this one does a remarkable job of allowing us to see the dark humor in their predicament, but also to recognize that their own foibles are responsible to a certain degree for some of their predicament. But there's a wonderful empathy for them at the same time that he's heaping misfortune upon misfortune on them. I agree with you 100% that stylistically, it is a tour de force. I mean, what other novelist can come up with 15 different voices and not have you say, no, wait, how do I tell Darryl from Cash? So it's hard for me to think of any element or any way in which it doesn't qualify.
Yeah, I think it's remarkable. And, you know, this really, it stands in a way, we can think of a book that maybe is trying to do the same kind of thing and completely, in hindsight, fails. Although this writer who I'm offering up now as a canon buster for a couple of his books is the guy who couldn't do as well as Faulkner, as much as he tried to kind of come along as almost an exact contemporary. His first novel is 1929. And this is Erskine Caldwell.
Sure.
He grows up in small town Georgia. He becomes a very big deal. And the novel that really puts him on the road is Tobacco Road, coming out just 2 years after this, the same year that Faulkner publishes Light in August, which is his follow-up, by the way, to As Lay Dying, talking about hitting the trifecta there of the books he wrote in a row, Sound and a Fury, As They Lay Dying, Light in August. That's pretty, you know, Sanctuary is published in between them, but the ones he's writing are those three right in a row, and it's just remarkable.
This is Bob Dylan in 1965, 1966.
That's exactly right. And with Erskine Caldwell, everything we talked about Faulkner not doing poorly, Caldwell does do poorly. He overly sexualizes these quote-unquote kind of primitive young women who are just all fertile and part of the land, so their goal should be just to have sex outdoors a lot. He has these characters. He doesn't quite figure out how to do the vernacular misspelling and the syntax in a way that we're really Faulkner so far ahead of everyone else. Of you feel the accent and the language because of word choice and arrangement, not because of over all the misspellings.
He makes poetry out of dialect in a way that Caldwell cannot.
And of course, Steinbeck fails in that. Zora Neale Hurston fails in that. And what we have in Steinbeck and Zora Neale Hurston is all the great writing between the moments of dialogue that make us not care. Caldwell doesn't really bring that. And so we had this one in the Tobacco Road, and his other big book, probably his best book, but one that also shows all the problems, is God's Little Acre, which comes out in 1933.
Which was supposed to be a proletariat novel. Caldwell's problem was he was essentially, you know, writing pornography before there was pornography. It's not explicit by any means, but that's how it was taken up.
Yeah.
And so it's remarkable to think how popular that guy was in the 40s on up through about the late 60s, kind of in the heyday of paperback. But if you ever want a good illustration of why, how an author allows themselves to be stereotyped or can't transcend those sorts of sleazy stereotypes, look at the paperback covers of Caldwell books. I mean, to a T, they are all just so cheesy. The difference is they fit the tone of the books perfectly.
Yeah.
They do not do a disservice in the way those paperbacks do to Faulkner or to Hemingway.
Yeah.
It's not cheesing them up because the cheese is in the books.
I think Caldwell also, you said Faulkner decided how to write is ignore the marketplace and just write what he knew he could write. The short stories that he'd write for the marketplace to make money, much like Fitzgerald, right? And of course, he was never the giant star in the slick magazine circuit that Fitzgerald was in his heyday, but he was pretty successful and published plenty in things like Saturday Evening Post and all that. But with Caldwell, he knew the audience and he knew people didn't want to see Faulkner, they want to see Beverly Hillbillies. And so he gave them a violent, sexed up,
right,
you know, cliche books. And you will find critics, and some of whom I admire, who read more of that into Caldwell. But for me, he's a cautionary tale.
My view, he's the Ma and Pa Kettle of literature. If you remember those comedians, you know, it's just stereotype after stereotype. There, I cannot think of a single Caldwell character that I gave to Rats Patooties about, but I have an immense sort of empathy for Darrell, Vardaman, even Cash, even Jewel. Mance, maybe not so much.
And I even feel sympathy for Addie.
Yeah.
You know, what if she had been able to, you know, she and Whiteside had run off together, or Whitefield, whatever the preacher's name is, instead of her feeling trapped and just growing in her disdain and kind of not hatred for her family, but not love other than for Jewel, and probably hatred for France. Well, you really, the word you've used several times, it is at the heart of As They Lay Dying, is empathy. And that is, of course, that thing that goes back to that symbol of the cross and Darrell as the scapegoat. He's not a Christ figure who's willingly sacrificing himself, but his ability to have insight into everyone else's point of view is all about empathy, putting yourself in the other person's shoes and understanding them. And that is what so many of these other writers don't really get. These are just characters to belittle or make fun of.
My biggest fear for As I Lay Dying is it's going to become the kind of high school Faulkner book, where it's, because it is the acceptable edge of the unacceptable stuff, that it becomes the only exposure that people have to Faulkner. And I really do still in my heart think that if you have not made it through The Sound and the Fury and Absalom, Absalom and Light in August, you really have not had the full Faulknerian experience.
Absolutely. But wouldn't you put this one next?
Oh yeah, I mean it's on equal footing with the six or seven, you know, all stars. And again, you just have to sit there in awe and think one followed another, that he was firing these off on one a year and on full cylinders. Now Absalom took a little while longer, but you know that streak is really unparalleled in American literature.
It truly is. So, Kirk, our next novel is?
All right. Well, we are going to jump ahead a few decades, and I'm excited about doing this book. I think we'll have a healthy debate about whether it qualifies as a GAN, but we are going to do Joan Didion's 1970 novel, Play It As It Lays, probably one of the most famous Hollywood, California novels. It's maybe a book that people don't read as much now because Didion is largely remembered for her nonfiction. But at one point, it was the great white hope of literature as we entered the 70s.
Absolutely. I'm looking forward to it. We thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please follow us on Apple, Spotify, Google Play, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcast. And if you're inclined to leave a review, we would appreciate that. If you've enjoyed this one, you may also enjoy others such as Master of the 40 with Kirk and Robert Trogdon, focusing on the short stories of F. Scott Fitzgerald, and Reading McCarthy with myself and various guests about the works of Cormac McCarthy.
And please remember, you can always email us at greatamericannovelpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.